You're listening to The Word from Westwood, a series of podcasts featuring sermons preached at Westwood United Methodist Church in Los Angeles, California.
There's a photo that Linda and I have at home, which evokes floods of memories every time I cast my glance that way. It was from our son Mark's baptism back in 1987. And this particular picture is of Mark's four great-grandmothers, all four of them standing together that day, which is really a pretty amazing thing when you think about it, that all four great-grandmothers were there. I guess it was good genes at work. Now, the four women that are in this picture, Ruth and Evelyn and Kathleen and Antonia, represented disparate traditions and experiences. One of them grew up in Vancouver, BC, only to find life radically changed when her surgeon father died at a very young age. Another called an abandoned boxcar home when she started out life in Ouray, Colorado. One of the four was a city girl from Wahoo, Nebraska, who became the wife of a farmer. And the other spent the first two decades of life in Bibali and Buje, places that at various times were part of Croatia, Yugoslavia, and Italy. You see, these four women had very far-flung experiences. And when I look at that picture, I can't help but reflect on how these four women live on in different ways in the life of the Woodall family. There are mannerisms, and there are attitudes and stories, and of course, food traditions that are still alive three generations later. There are attitudes about faith and the church that have been passed along. They are definitely part of our cloud of witnesses that we remember today on All Saints Day. Witnesses who were not perfect people, but witnesses who nevertheless made an indelible impression on successive generations. These women are part of Linda and my children's roots. Observing All Saints is a reminder to us that we are part of a continuity that started long before any of us appeared on this earth. And it's a continuity that will continue long after our earthly lives end. Our Westwood history, here an example, starts back in 1929. In fact, one of the people we remembered today, Betty Adams, she was a member of the Helms family who were here the day the first cornerstone was set in place over at Warner in Wilshire. In fact, Betty told me stories about remembering that when she was 6 years old and that cornerstone was put into place. There are countless laity and clergy who have been woven into the tapestry that is our church. For some, it was a short season. For others, it has meant multiple generations. These witnesses have been responsible for some of the vision that is unique to this congregation. This has indeed been a place that's valued tradition, but it is also a place that frequently has challenged the status quo, as long as any of us here can remember. Yes, Westwood certainly has its cloud of witnesses that continue to inform and challenge and nudge us along in being a faithful witness and a faithful church. Of course, it's not just recent history that informs who we are as a faith community. It goes far back to the personalities that we have been encountering each week in the Hebrew Scriptures. These stories are a critical part of our roots. Whether or not the details completely hold up historically, the remembered narratives working together point to a greater truth, largely because of this narrative's ability to clearly identify our human condition. The beauty of these texts is that these saints are anything but perfect. Tragedy, triumph, mistakes, success. They are all a part of who we were and who we are today, and these ancient stories continue to inform our present and future. So the story today about King Rehoboam is no exception. Sometimes the history that is most important to remember involves huge mistakes and scoundrels, for lack of a better word. Said another way, sometimes the most important lessons we learn are how not to do things. Rehoboam, as the story tells us, was the son of King Solomon. He was the fourth king to reign over the united monarchy of Israel. And at the time of his ascendancy, what we sometimes forget is that there were already major problems and unrest among God's people. While his father Solomon had been known for his wisdom, he also had a taste for building an imperial city. His building programs in Jerusalem, especially the temple, were brought to fruition through heavy taxation and what some might call the slave labor of his own people. King David, Solomon's father, had hoped that Jerusalem would be a neutral ground, but that is not what evolved for the kingdom of Israel. The establishment of the temple in Jerusalem was considered a real blow to the many other religious sanctuaries that were already a part of this kingdom that was called Israel. You see, there really was not a completely unified religious expression among God's people. And what is often forgotten, that the kingdom had already started to disintegrate under the leadership of Solomon. So when it was time for Rehoboam to take the throne, the area of Shechem is the locale where this took place, where he was to be anointed. And this was far away from Jerusalem in the northern part of the kingdom. Perhaps it was a placating measure, creating some distance from Solomon. Now, we're introduced to the character Jeroboam, who had been a superintendent of works under Solomon, a very responsible position. And we were told that during that period, Jeroboam fled from King Solomon to take exile in the land of Egypt. Well, when Rehoboam appeared as king, it seemed a possible opportunity that wrongs would be righted, wrongs from the past. So Jeroboam came out of exile, and he came and confronted King Rehoboam and spoke about the heavy yoke that had been placed among the on top of the people by Solomon. Basically, he was saying to the new king, Rehoboam, how are you going to correct this? What are you going to do about this situation? Well, Jeroboam was told by King Rehoboam to go away and return in 3 days for the answer. Are you with me so far? Are we keeping Jeroboam straight and King Rehoboam straight? It gets even more complicated as we go along. So the king, Rehoboam, in what looked like a very encouraging action, sought counsel from the elders who had been a part of his father's court. And the sage advice, as the story tells us, was very simple. Be a servant to them. Speak good words to them. And if you do that, they will be your servants forever. If he had only stopped at that point and listened to that advice. Instead, Rehoboam decided to talk to some of his peers. I guess in this case, a very dangerous thing. And their advice to him, to paraphrase it, was stick it to him. Along with the statement where he made this memorable point that, Rehoboam, you shouldn't be any pushover, and that you're more powerful than your father. And so you go out there and you tell him, my little finger is thicker than my father's loins. That's what he was to tell them. Now, friends, this is another place where the translators are loath to say what was really meant here. Do I need to go further, or you understand physiologically what we're talking about here today? Oh, the euphemisms that are in the Old Testament. Well, friends, it led to disaster. trifling with Jeroboam was a great mistake. And what ensued from this was Jeroboam challenging the authority of Rehoboam, resulting in Jeroboam also becoming a king for the dissatisfied tribes, which eventually led to civil war. One decision and what it cost. So these 10 northern tribes became the kingdom of Israel. And Jeroboam, we are told, built golden calves to be their new gods because he wanted a distinct separation from the kingdom of Judah, where Jerusalem was the center, and now the new kingdom of Israel. And he didn't want them worshiping in the temple in Jerusalem, so he built them the new gods. Well, it was a watershed moment in ancient history, which eventually led to 39 kings that would rule over Judah and Israel. And if you look at what the texts have to say, according to the historians and according to the prophets, only 9 of those 39 were considered people of good character and pleasing to God. Only 9 of the 39. In fact, in the first Bible I ever had, in the back in one of those indices, it has good kings and bad kings. And the bad king list, as you can imagine, was very, very long. So the result of all of this was eventually the fall of the kingdom of Israel. It disappeared in 722 BC. And ultimate Judah, the kingdom where Jerusalem was the center, fell in 586 BC when the people were put into exile. In short, from the perspective of God's prophets, the monarchy was nothing but a dismal failure, something from which there was never a full recovery. And you remember last week when we were talking about Samuel and the installation of the kings and how Samuel warned, you don't want to have a king. Well, this was the result of that story, how it connects to this larger narrative. Well, the real issue for those of us who grapple with this story is the advice that was proffered to Rehoboam and the choice he made. You see, it really was about a question of putting personal and, shall we say, selfish interests over the interests of the people, the bigger community. His elder advisors, probably having learned from watching King Solomon stumble so often, counseled this new king, Rehoboam, to show compassion to the people who had been abused and oppressed. What good was Solomon's imperial city if the masses hated their king, the city, and the abuse of power which all of it represented? The sage advice fully acknowledged the errors which Solomon had made. And their advice to Rehoboam offered a possibility of bringing back together the people of this troubled kingdom, offering the hope of a different way, a different future. What a contrast this was to the advice that Rehoboam's peers offered. Their viewpoint was, make it all about you. Make it all about you and your needs. Be the macho man. In fact, go ahead and use that macho man image. And if they complain about the way they are treated, show them, treat them even worse. Further, they wanted him, his peers wanted him to make it clear that he was all powerful. And their job was to obey him. And disobedience would not be met with whips. Disobedience would now be met with scorpions. It's a particularly challenging message for people who wield power and control over others, wouldn't you say? This story points out the folly of what happens when it becomes all about me, all about having power and domination over others. Granted, monarchs are generally all about power and control, but the point of the prophets is that there is a better way. There's a better way. And for people like us, I expect it is our job to find ourselves in this story by realizing that we are, by and large, the people who have power and control. Identifying ourselves as those who are oppressed and downtrodden is disingenuous at best. We're certainly well into right now what seems like this never-ending season of presidential politics. And regardless of where any of us stand politically, I think it's safe to say that humility is not a quality that's generally exhibited during the time of debates and jockeying for position. There are Jeroboams and Rehoboams filling the airwaves and the internet. I hear a lot of discussion that wants to scapegoat large groups of people, and very little discussion about the importance of our working to hold up one another, working together. Now, this should really be important to those of us who choose to be followers of Jesus. Because, you see, we really should be asking ourselves some hard questions. Yes, I know, it is critical to keep a separation between church and state. But I would also ask us, does our mandate to treat neighbors as self, does that show up in our discussions? And does that show up in our choices? Especially since Jesus made it so clear that our neighbors include a much larger array of people which are going to always push us beyond our comfort zone. Because that's what it means to love neighbor as self. And I'm not sure I hear much of that going on in the debate and the dialogue right now. So friends, I ask us the question, where do we find ourselves in this story? Or more importantly, how do we go about making our choices? Where do we find the balance between personal need and responsibility to the larger group? Is that a part of our consideration in our decision-making process? The communion table right here around which we will gather is a bold reminder to us that it is all about the needs of the community, the needs of the family working together, something that was forgotten both by Jeroboam and Rehoboam. Will we default to faulty patterns that are ancient in origin? Or will we seek the better way? Will we seek the better way? Amen.
Westwood United Methodist Church is located at 10497 Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles, between Westwood Village and Beverly Hills. Sundays are at the heart of this faith community's life, and we invite you to worship every Sunday at 10 a.m. A wide variety of opportunities for all ages are also available every week. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.westwoodumc.org or call the church office at area code 310-474-4511. I'm Janet Hoskins. Westwood United Methodist Church. Do justice, love kindness, walk humbly with God.